Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of the Charity Charge Show. Today, I am delighted to be here with my friend, Janet Torres, who is the Executive Director of the Literacy Coalition of Central Texas. This month marks her one-year anniversary. So congratulations, Janet, and thank you for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Great to be here, Stephen. Thank you. This is a long time coming.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say that you know, we've known each other now for many years, going back to your work with the Kindness Campaign.
Yes.
And I've always enjoyed our interactions together. So it's really a pleasure to be able to do this. The podcast, generally, the theme in my approach is two parts. I mean, one, I want everyone to learn about your work at Literacy Coalition of Central Texas and why it's important, and any interesting statistics or numbers or things you can talk about, or anecdotes, stories. That's super important. And I also know that a lot of our listeners are aspiring nonprofit leaders themselves, you know, and look up to people like yourselves that are in these executive director types of positions. So I definitely want to dive a bit into your background and your journey and your career in the nonprofit and social impact space.
Yes, I'm so happy to. And thank you for mentioning my one-year anniversary. I'm so happy we're doing the podcast. It's on a Wednesday, and you caught me in a really great mood, because every Wednesday morning since March of last year, I hold a half an hour coffee time with anyone on my team. So from 9 to 9:30, you sign up, and we could talk about anything: coffee, the sky is blue. And most of the time, we start talking about, and it's open to any staff member. We also have AmeriCorps members and VISTA members. I'll talk a little bit about how they're connected to the Literacy Coalition. But I've been booked every Wednesday, you know, outside of taking some days off and holidays. I've been booked every Wednesday since last March.
Wow.
And it's like the happiest half an hour to an hour that I get to spend just talking to my teammates.
And how long have you been doing this?
I started the coffee time with my team. I started in February of last year, and I started coffee time in March of last year. And I've been booked every single Wednesday from 9 to 9:30.
Let's talk about this. You know, I never know where these episodes are going to go, but I will mention, and I'll leave them unnamed, but I was on with earlier this morning, I was having a work-related call with one of the organizations we work with. And their executive director, their whole team is remote. And she was asking me, and the majority of the Charity Charge team, well, I should say differently, we're now all remote. Some of them are in Austin, where I'm based, and from a legal perspective, the company is headquartered, but we've got a remote team all across the country, even some members internationally now, which is really cool. Anyway, the executive director that I was speaking with was just saying, you know, how it's difficult to do that, and what are some of the things that we do from managing remote workforce? So talk to us about that. And this seems like it's been a great component. So what have you learned through this, and how did you decide to do it?
I was hired, and I interviewed for this position and hired all remote. I did not see my teammates until early May of 2021. So to be, so a lot of people have asked me, how did that go? Like being hired and starting a brand new position, remotely, it was tough. And that was part of the challenge. When I took this position, it was really important to the board that the team, had someone that they can talk to. They wanted the team to feel supported. And that's one of the things that is really important to me is community and culture in an organization, and feeling that we can tear down these walls of titles and, literally like, so what, I'm the CEO, in a way, so what, there's a board. So many times throughout my career, people have been, felt this barrier to interacting with, the C-suite or the board members. Oh, very scary people, or they've been kept purposely away. And, that's not something I wanted. I always said, you know, trust is earned, not given. And so I needed to create, especially because I was remote, how do I create a sense of belonging that this team yearned for, a sense of respect for who they are and what they do. These are incredible people I work with every single day who've devoted their lives to helping adult learners get their high school equivalency, to finishing vocational training, to learning English, to moving forward. So what I did is I decided, how can I connect with them? I love coffee and I love talking. So and also I'm a big fan of Mike Myers Coffee Time. And I'm originally from New York City, close to Long Island. I was born and raised in Queens, New York. So I don't know if I have too much of my New York accent still, since I've been living here in Texas for 7 years, but it's coffee time. You know, it's like, I love coffee. And Mike Myers had a very famous, that's so funny. I kind of modeled my coffee time over Mike Myers coffee time. It's so funny because, you know, for those of you who are, you know, younger than 30 years old, you're not going to know too much about Mike Myers and Coffee Time on Saturday Night Live. So most of my team are, you know, in their 30s, if not in their 20s. So I had to explain it to them. They kind of got it. I thought it was a lot funnier than they thought it was. And so we started this Coffee Time where, again, there's no pressure to sign up. I didn't think anybody was going to sign up, maybe one or two people. And it really took off. Where every Wednesday from 9 to 9:30, we just talk about coffee, we talk about life, we talk about, they all are very interested in my journey of being in the public sector. And I've devoted my entire career, except for 2 years of my career, and I've been working for a long time. I started working, you know, since 1990, right out of college. And they wanted to understand my journey, which they're going through right now, public policy of, you know, service to the community. And we talk a lot about that. And we talk about, I want to hear about where, you know, their journey and where do they want to go, especially our AmeriCorps members. I don't know, for your audience who don't know, AmeriCorps members is a federal program, and it's a year of service that most of the people who are participating are straight out of college. And they're exploring ways of direct service in the community. Many of them go off then to grad school for social work or public policy, or go to law school, or go into a totally different direction in a totally different field. But it's a beautiful way to connect young people and get them excited about nonprofit work. So many of my discussions with the AmeriCorps members is about their journey. Where do you want to go to school? Why do you want to study this program that they're interested in? And what I found, a lot of times the discussion revolves around how they feel that they haven't done enough, that they feel like they need to make a decision right here about the rest of their career. And they have to make a decision, you know, about this is exactly what I'm going to study. And I've told them, everyone's journey is different. You don't need to say, I'm going to go to law school by the age of 23. And by the age of 26, I'm going to be done with law school. I'm going to be done with this grad program. And I'm going to do X, Y, Z. You're 21, 22 years old. I told them there are other ways to explore work for a few years, figure it out, then decide, hey, I really am interested in X, Y, and Z. That's what I did. So we talk a lot about my background, and we always have part twos. A lot of people are repeat, folks that sign up for Coffee Time. But again, it's my happiest, you know, even if I wake up tired or frustrated about anything else that's going on, that is like my precious time. And it always invigorates me to talk to my team members, my direct reports, or AmeriCorps members. So I get to talk to everybody who necessarily wouldn't have a relationship with a CEO, put it that way. Wow. That was my goal.
How many people are a part of your team, including the AmeriCorps and Vista?
Oh, so we have about 17 part-time, wow, full-time workers, employees, sorry. And then we have about, if you include because we train AmeriCorps members in literacy services, and then we place them throughout a whole bunch of nonprofits, you know, that you've spoken to, I'm sure, on your podcast throughout Central Texas and especially in Travis County. And that can be anywhere from like 30 to 40. Plus we have VISTA members who don't do direct service. It's also a federal volunteer program. It's for people who provide capacity building for nonprofits. So for instance, we have a VISTA, and she is developing some policies and procedures and helping us with our, kind of redefining our development and communications. So a lot of them, so it's a lot of people that sure. I've talked to and I'm continuing to talk to. And the AmeriCorps members and the VISTA members, have been exposed to my coffee time because I've given talks that we have professional development where guest speakers come in to talk to AmeriCorps members and VISTA members about what's life like after, what do you do after AmeriCorps and VISTA? These people are going to have conversations with you and presentations about what they do. And part of that, I always say, hey, I'd love for you guys to sign up for coffee time. It's like, wow, I'm booked probably through the end, I'm probably booked through April, not May. It's really mm-hmm. tough. Like one person well, started.
I'm curious, knowing that the demand is that high, and not just, I don't think it's just for coffee time itself, but that yearning for all the reasons why they're booking that you're talking about. Have you thought, or do you do other team building type of exercises, either with yourself or ways that you connect the different people on your team together?
We have not, but I think
this is kind of gives you some insight. You know what I mean? If that demand is so strong, how do you find a way to keep it going? Because I think you've tapped into something that's really strong. And I think there are a lot of great things that have come out of the pandemic, and said in a silver lining type of way. And the barrier of communication that you can just hop on a Zoom really helps connect people and make that process so much easier. Because I could totally relate to you the barrier that I think a lot of people feel in certainly larger organizations, from the idea of, a junior level employee talking to someone that's not necessarily their direct report. So you've started to create something pretty interesting here, I think,
And I have to say, Zoom has not been a barrier. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is, but I find that there's a lot of connection. I think people are just yearning for connection and for mentorship. And I think they're just a lot of, I think the signups are this, they're just curious. Like, am I really this person that they're seeing, that there's, mm-hmm. That I lead with empathy and kindness. That's something that I learned from Andrea Lamont, who's the founder of the Kindness Campaign. And I was her first executive director of that. And I learned there the importance of being kind and empathetic is incredibly key, not just for children, but for adults. And so I've taken a lot of those lessons I learned that we were imparting to adults and children, and I brought it to this position. And part of my presentations to the AmeriCorps members and the VISTA members is, those are, to me, kindness and empathy are such important leadership tools to bring, and how each of them are leaders from the very beginning. You're not a leader just because you're a director. You're not just a leader because you're a CEO. Everyone on the team is a leader. And I wanted them to understand that. And that to me, the value that you bring to the table of being a leader who can be empathetic, who listens, who's actively listening to you, who wants the best for you in your personal and in your work life. I think people are still shocked that I'm bringing that to the table for them. Because I've always yearned for that in my career. Mm-hmm. And it really hasn't, when I started out, I was in government as a legislative attorney. And it's like, God forbid that you cried or you showed emotion. you know, people were always told me like, grow up, stop being so, you know, sensitive. Well, that's my personality. And that's where my heart, you know, I'm just a person that leads with my heart. But I always tell people, don't mistake my kindness for weakness, because I am far from being weak and a pushover. But I try to impart the, you know, those values and those leadership skills that I think are very high on the list. So, you know, AmeriCorps members can move forward with that.
I could tell, knowing you for, I mean, at this point, probably 3 years or so now,
yeah.
And then hearing you speak about this and in your newer role with Literacy Coalition of Central Texas, it's so obvious your authenticity and your excitement of what you're doing as, you know, as a job is just, you know, invigorates you and is something that you feel very passionate about and is meaningful. You were talking about, you know, your prior life as an attorney. I think that what sort of advice would you give to people that maybe are stuck in a career and are unhappy and are trying to figure out, I mean, how did you pivot around to get to where you are today? What are some of those lessons you took?
Well, I always knew from a very young age, I wanted to do something civic minded, you know, when I went to university, Fordham University, that had a real, in the Bronx in New York City, mm-hmm. Go Rams. And they, part of the, what they imparted is a sense of being part of a community, giving back. So that was, I always felt like that was in my DNA. And it just grew while I was at Fordham University. And then I decided to study poli-sci, and I did public administration, a little economics. and then I was like, you know, well, I kind of want to be a lawyer, but not sure that's what I wanted to do. I didn't know if I wanted to get a master's in public policy. I mean, I was 21 years old, but I did some great internships. In my last semester of college, I was in Albany, New York, the capital of New York State. And I was part of a program that placed me in a state agency, and I worked on projects. Like, it wasn't like I was an intern and made copies. Like, they're like, you're going to work on a project, you know, at 20 years old. And then I got into I decided to go forward and apply for the New York City Urban Fellows Program, which is, I credit that program. It's been around for 50 years in New York City. It was started by Mayor Wagner 50 years ago. And the that is to help recent graduates to become the managers of the future of city agencies. And I got a chance to work and apply to several different agencies. It was a year-long fellowship. And I got, at the age of 21, 22, I was running a program for, at the time, called Human Resource Administration. I worked in the Department of Homeless Services. This is, 30 years ago. You know, names have changed of agencies. But I worked directly with the assistant commissioner and sometimes the commissioner. And they put me in charge of a program to help bring together different agencies at the time that instead of going out and talking to homeless individuals individually for services, you would come together as a team. So someone from human resources, someone from mental health services, housing would kind of do these teams. Or anyway, it's amazing. So to me, that would kind of make me think, wow, I really want to do public policy. I love this idea that I can have direct social impact by creating programs that can affect people's lives for the better. And I thought, hey, I'm going to go get my master's now. So I tell a lot of my, you know, young people who come ask me about my career, I'm like, you don't have to go to school right away. But I was part of a fellowship that gave me that exposure. And the beautiful thing is that so many of my colleagues who were part of that cohort have become elected officials, you know, in the state Senate. You know, mayors have come out of that. Commissioners have come out of this program in 50 years. So we're all part of a very amazing and storied, you know, fellowship program that has produced some really amazing people doing a great work in the public sector. So I kind of just decided I wanted to devote my career to the public sector. decided Masters of Public Policy wasn't for me. Even though I got into school, mom still gets mad at me because I gave up a full ride to keep working. And I was working on redistricting, and that's where I caught the legal bug, really caught the legal bug. And someone said, you know what, you should go to law school. You can do public policy, and there's this thing called being a legislative attorney. I'm like, what's that? That's amazing. I get to write the law. And so I found at the time, one law school at the time, Boston University School of Law, graduated 1997. And they had an incredible clinic for legislative drafting. And that's what I focused on. And thus, then my career started at the New York City legislature. I focused on economic development and emerging technology, small business. So I got a chance to really make an impact by writing some really great pieces of legislation that I got a chance to do, and just amazing. And just went from there. And then when I got kind of burnt out, I worked for some large cultural institutions, nonprofit cultural institutions in New York, such as the Bronx Zoo.
Let's not skip over that. What do you think it was that got you burnt out, and how quickly did you recognize that and then transition? Because that's where I think a lot of people get stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, when you work in government, especially, I mean, for me, being in the legislative branch, working for the speaker. So I was part of like the speaker staff, and working in the committee structure. It's a 24/7 job, you know, it's like, there's no putting it away, right? You get a call, hey, you know, this is happening. Or, you know, you got to make sure that the legislation is placed on the desk 3 days before the vote by midnight. And there were plenty of times, you know, I would help colleagues and colleagues would help me place legislation on the tables before that deadline of midnight. You know, it's just all consuming. But I think it's a little bit of my personality. It kind of like I'm all in, and I'm still struggling with balance and self-care. Again, that I've learned a lot more, and it's more accepted now.
Sure.
You know, we're talking about the early 2000s through the mid 2000s and, you know, into the 2010s, where it just wasn't accepted. Like telling someone, oh, you know, I got to, you know, self-care is important. It just that wasn't part of the conversation. And it took a long time. When you started seeing that there's more discussion about that. So I tell folks who are starting their careers, how lucky you are to be starting your career now, where the discussion is already there about self-care, balance. I still, you know, struggle with it. But that was part, that was, I think was the time of the time period I was in that led to a lot of burnout. And so I think what's important for folks to remember is that, you know, that it's an everyday, you have to work on it every day. It's like a muscle, right? That muscle of self-care, that muscle of balance, because it's so easy. I fall into it still in this current position. You know, I'm like, how can I just be working 10 hours? And I haven't done anything. I haven't gone for a walk. Yeah. So I think it's just, again, I still think it's a challenge, but I think we're in a time that is more accepting of this versus, you know, when I started out, it was extremely frowned upon.
It's so interesting how I think that it's changed even from my perspective over the past handful of years. And I think though that COVID, you know, there was a lot of burnout of people just nonstop working in this even more digital. So in some yes. ways, I think it's more accepted, but then I think when it, even though it's more accepted, people still push to the extreme because we all want to delight others, you know, and we want to show up and be there and be strong. But I've had to figure out a lot of ways in my own work life and personal life to take a step back and be easier.
on yourself, right?
Yeah.
I always say sometimes I tell people, give me grace, I'll give you grace, but also you have to give yourself the grace. You know, when you're being too hard on yourself. I kick myself all the time, right? But I give so many people grace, but I don't give it to myself all the time.
Right. Well, it's kind of timely because every Wednesday I get a text. I'm on a text thing with this guy, Dr. Mark Hyman, who he puts out a lot of content around healthy eating and living and all of that stuff. And he sends out a text a week, which I love. And today's was, you might be surprised to find out how many of your ruminating thoughts are negative or self-degrading. Someone once told me to talk to myself the way that I would talk to a friend who I loved. And that was game-changing advice. Once I started to do that, I noticed an improvement in my overall joy, self-compassion, and grace is key.
Oh my God. Oh man.
Yeah.
That's so, oh my God, Steve, that is so true, because my biggest goal, I have to admit, I'm a people pleaser also, right? I always want to be helping people.
Same here.
At the expense of myself sometimes,
yep.
Right?
Yeah.
But who has control? I have control of myself.
Yes.
So, you know, again, I want to be the leader that I wanted when I was 25 years old.
Yes.
I want to be the leader that I wanted when I was 35 years old and 45 years old. I'm not going to tell you how old I am. A little older than 45, but I want to be that leader for this generation that's just starting out. And I have many young individuals who are starting out their careers with the Literacy Coalition, and I'm okay with them flying the coop, you know, because, you know, this is their first and only job right out of an AmeriCorps program to be running programs. And I can, you know, and I want to be there. And I ask them all the time, how are you feeling? Like, it's one of my biggest things. Like, I'm always asking, how are you feeling? How are you doing? Are you have too much on your plate? What can I take? Make sure you're taking time off. But then I have to remember that I have to do the same thing for myself, because I think leaders tend to do a lot of sacrifice because they know, and especially in a nonprofit world. I mean, I haven't worked too much, except for 2 years of my career. I've always worked in a nonprofit, so I can only speak from that perspective. But all what was game changing for me is to hear other CEOs that I looked up to, who I thought, man, they got it made. And they're telling me, no, we go through this every day. These, you know, of stress and angst and working too hard.
Yes.
Like, oh my gosh.
For me, the biggest thing, and a lot of it's about, you know, being a CEO, is just how it can be lonely at the top, so to speak. And whenever I talk to my friends that are running businesses, it's so therapeutic to hear their perspective and what they're going through. And I think part of life that I found about this whole kind of aspect of mental health is recognizing that everyone goes through the same crap and realizing that it's normal to have a negative thought or be upset or whatever. And that there's, you know, tools that you can utilize to help feel better about the situation. And so the aspect of knowing that we're all going through it in different ways, but in a lot of the similar ways has been really helpful. So,
you know, it's so interesting. I don't think we could have written a script as good as this conversation is. This is a free flowing conversation,
because
what you just mentioned, you know, leads me to one of the things I really wanted to talk about today, which is, you know, vulnerability. That is part of another part of a tool in your leadership box. I find that you also, as a leader, I think you always have, you know, I think leaders are always, I'm fine, everything's great. You give this outward position of like strength and, you know, I got my shit together. But sometimes you're like, I'm terrified, or I don't know if I'm making the right decision, or, you know what, I'm just going to make a decision because I have to make a decision. And I think it's sometimes, and even when we're just talking about self-care and burnout, what I think is really important is that I started practicing this thing of being radical vulnerability with my board and my team, where it's okay. I can say, you know what? I'm feeling a little burnt out, or you know what? I may not have all the answers, and I get scared too sometimes. And that's been another game changer, I think. People have a different perspective. Again, I think sometimes, you know, leaders may be afraid to do it because they're going to be like, well, shouldn't I know everything? Or are they going to respect me less because I'm saying I don't have an answer? I disagree with that. I hope that practicing, you know, radical vulnerability as, you know, as a leadership skill has actually benefited me and has made me, I think that, you know, again, has humanized me to my staff and to my board members, and then vice versa.
I agree. I mean, it's such a 180 that you wouldn't think that that would be the case. And it's made all the difference. And I'm so open with my team about where we are, the metrics, revenue, all of mm-hmm. these things. And there were times when I was scared to do that. And we just had a big team gathering, had everyone in, and a handful, three of the people in particular, actually, I was the only one that had met some of them, and everyone else was the first time meeting in person because we just hadn't gotten together since the start of COVID. Two of the people that work for me are in Canada. So, you know, we were dealing with their, you know, they couldn't travel and all this stuff. And when we got all together, I started just laying out, hey, here's where we were 2 years ago in revenue. Here's where we were 1 year ago. Here's where we are today, but here's where we need to get to, you know, and here's why we need to get to there, you know? And part of it was, hey, I want to give you more raises. You know, it's like, I want you to benefit from the growth and all that. But I was curious, like, do I share that? Is it right? Should they really know all of our numbers and all that stuff? But then out of it has just been this, let's rally together, like just this more built in spirit. And like, I think people just really appreciate that transparency and that rawness. And then they can rise to the occasion. And I think you also can figure out if you don't have the right people on your team too. You know, sometimes when you share 100%. Those things, I was always, we're doing great now, you know, and I've obviously, I mean, this June will mark our sixth year being, you know, operational in business. But I mean, our first handful of years were so lean, you know, and I didn't even want to look at our bank account. You know, it's like, I didn't want anyone else knowing, like, you know, how tight we were running things and like, are we going to be able to make it? And, you know, now I look back on it and obviously that's what every business owner or new nonprofit started goes through. Right. I mean, obviously there's mm-hmm. some exceptions, but it's a struggle. It's an uphill climb when you're taking an idea and you're putting it into market and then you're trying to get your initial set of customers or users or members. And then from there, you're trying to scale it up and figure out how to do that in a cost-effective way. And yeah. So it's funny now to be able to do it, but I didn't always share it. And my own perspective, even though I'm the founder and CEO, I feel like everyone, we're all partners in this together. And I know they feel that way too. And it's created all that transparency. So not only do we get a better result, for charity charge, which means a better result for our nonprofits and for the world. But I then mentally I feel better about it. I don't feel like I'm just trying to push this boulder uphill alone. You know, you get real buy-in. So it's been a great thing for me to be able to learn. And it's nice to be able to speak to you about it in this setting and connect the dots. Because
that vulnerability of mm-hmm. like, I mean, listen, that's, you know, what you showed was vulnerability, right? Of the company finances, of you being a little scared, but you did it. And I agree with you. Listen, I even though I haven't had a lot of time in the private sector, I think most people agree that your nonprofit should be run as a business, right? It's a nonprofit yes. business, business nonetheless. And so, you know, part of what I wanted to bring to the table also was transparency. It's also that balance of like, you know, this team never being exposed to the budget, the true, like, where are the pain points? 100% agree with you. In this last year, that was the goal, is that's what my team yearned for. They wanted more information. And so we're giving it to them for the first time, right? This is the approved budget. You know, monthly we sit down and we break apart your program budget, and we're going to, so you can understand, this is how much you can spend. This is how much you have in a grant. This is what you can't spend because it's unfunded. And I agree with you. It's exactly where your team ended up, was their understanding and then rising to that information has been presented to them. Like, now they are stakeholders in this. They understand that, okay, we're not, Janet's not just over here trying to raise us money and, and just get us the money, versus no, there's a reason, there's ebbs and flow in funding. And so they really appreciate that. And then I'm making them more of partners and understanding the grants that they get, the contracts that we've signed and the outcomes that are needed and their input of like, what can be done better. So I think that transparency of finances is really important. I think that it's a little scary for nonprofits to show that. And some boards may be like, no. But again, it goes back to what I was saying earlier, how we tend to, sometimes CEOs are coming across like, everything is great. Well, it's not always great. And maybe your organization, don't paint it as like, there's nothing ever wrong in the organization. You don't want to scare anyone to death that they'll run away and leave the job. But like you said, again, either people want to stay and, work with you and the organization and your business in particular to keep it growing, or, they want to leave, and that's okay too.
Tell me, I appreciate all of that and everything we've talked about. A few of the things you were just mentioning there, we're talking about some of the coaching that you provide to the partner nonprofits. I want to shift gears because I do want to make sure that we spend a little bit of time specifically on the organization itself and your work there, which you all are doing. I'll just give a background. Literacy Coalition of Central Texas is celebrating 20 years. Pretty incredible.
Thank you.
And, I just was pulling up the website and looking back over a bunch of things. I'll read off some of these statistics that are there, but more than 43 million adults in the United States read, write, or do basic math at a third grade level. 82% of children whose parents have no high school diploma are likely to live in poverty. And 47% of immigrants ages 5 and older have limited English speaking proficiency. That was done in 2018. So I want to use that, as a segue. Can you tell us about what Literacy Coalition of Central Texas is all about? And then I know your model, working with different nonprofits, maybe share some of the commonalities. You were touching on it, but I'm curious of other nonprofits that are listening in, maybe there'll be some takeaways that they can learn about, the advice and the stewardship that you're providing to your partner nonprofits.
Yeah, absolutely. So, our mission is to break intergenerational poverty. And it used to be through comprehensive literacy services, but we changed it to holistic literacy services. And, we also envision a community that's 100% employable and that's self-sufficient and literate. And so it's important for us to we focus on working with adults. And so we have like three main buckets: our adult education, and we're helping individuals get their high school equivalency. That's based on that statistic you read, the first two. A parent or individual who has a high school diploma earns more, of course, also has an ability to, bring their family, out of poverty, because there are many jobs that require a high school diploma. And then you have that huge number of 43 million people who don't even have a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So for 20 years, a group of individuals came together and realized that, working together in literacy services versus, individually, you always can't, crack that nut of like getting more people their high school diplomas. We're not one of those. A lot of people have been confused with us over the years about, we do so many things, But our biggest thing is to help adults get their high school equivalency, helping them through vocational training that we have. We have this really cool, unique program that's, you know, we work with partner organizations like Austin Career Institute. We provide the what we call contextualized English as a second language and work readiness mm-hmm. program. Austin Career Institute provides the HVAC, the students go through. And so that's really unique because it's literacy that leads to workforce development, that leads to a career. And we always said that literacy, is opportunity. It's that baseline that helps to self-sufficiency and employability. And then we have our family education program. We work with parents and children from 18 months to 4 years old to get those children ready for kindergarten. And there's one statistic that's not there on the website that we are going to put there. But listen to this, everybody. 38% of children in Central Texas, only 38% are kindergarten ready. That's a really sad statistic. So what are we doing? We focus on adults, but we also focus on this family education program to make sure that our children from our Parents Little Scholars program are going to be ready for kindergarten, be successful. Their parents are learning to understand their child's social, emotional, cognitive pieces of their child, aspects of their child to help their children become more successful in school. And also, we don't want to see these children as adults. Like, that's the goal. We don't want to see them coming in through our doors ever as adults. And so part of what we do also, and this goes to, we have about 67 partners from all different agencies in Central Texas, and most of them are in Travis County. And many of them provide their own literacy services, provide their own parenting programs. But what we do is that we amplify our work by bringing on board AmeriCorps members. We train them in literacy. We train them in a cutting edge English as a second language program that we developed. And then we amplify our work and we place them in these other organizations and help them grow. And so that's how we're able to amplify our work and push out our programs to 67 other organizations by, training AmeriCorps members.
That's excellent. I think that it's always interesting. I mean, where do you attack the problem, upstream or downstream? And sometimes you got to do it on both sides.
Yeah.
Which is obviously where.
And the thing is, of course we do direct services, but again, what we do, we always say we're a lab. We do things first with our own clients. And then we say, okay, now we want to, show this to other nonprofits. So, we've trained other nonprofits in our English Forward system for teaching English as a second language, not just our AmeriCorps members. We also have an incredible social service department that provides what we call wraparound case management. Because if you're hungry, you can't pay your rent, you're having, you're experiencing trauma in your life, how can you then be successful in any course that you're taking with us? How can you finish your high school equivalency, obtain your high school equivalency? So we have this incredible group of individuals who provide emergency assistance. Right now we're working with a client who needs help to pay her rent. And she's a long-term student of ours. And then they may need, referral to health benefits, or, there's food insecurity issues. So we're constantly helping them while they're in class. They come to us for referrals, for talking, for assistance. And many of our clients are also survivors of violence. So, we work with them in a trauma-informed way. So one of the things that has been developed through our social services is, we've always trained our caseworkers and our staff on looking through the lens and talking to a student through trauma-informed care. So many people have suffered trauma. How do you deal with someone who suffered trauma? Also, there's a thing called motivational interviewing skills. How do you talk to someone where you're not triggering them and they close down on you? You know, there's a way to say, you know, in a different way, oh, you failed this test. Well, oh my God, that's going to cause me trauma, because the whole reason I don't have my high school diploma is because I was traumatized by people and failing exams.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we've created these training programs that we just did internally, but now we are training, over 3 years, we've trained over 2,000 individuals and other nonprofits.
Wow.
On these on understanding how to deal with someone through a trauma, you know, providing service through a trauma-informed care lens, and how do you work with them in a way that is positive and affirming to an individual so they will lead them to success. That's a lot of people, you know, and right now we're in the midst of training all of Workforce Solution centers. Workforce Solutions of the Capital Area, they have workforce centers. And we're doing now our second time round of training for all of their three centers for their staff. And they're learning the skills of trauma-informed care, how to implement motivational interviewing. So that's another way we provide, we're amplifying all this work that's touching thousands of people, right? Because then how many people do the people in Workforce Solutions touch? Like we haven't, you know, we would love to be able to count those numbers. Right? Like you're talking about thousands and thousands of people that are now doing, being able to, you know, do a better job of providing, you know, help to individuals. So, yeah.
That's excellent.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for doing what you're doing for our community.
Thank you. Well, so you know, important. I appreciate that. And, you know, again, I've dedicated my entire career and my life to this. As you can see, I'm still like smiling and motivated, and I see, you know, that, you know, people, we can change the world. And so it's been just a pleasure being a part of the Literacy Coalition of Central Texas.
That's awesome. If people are interested in learning more, getting involved, supporting your work, where should they go? You want to tell them your website URL?
Sure. Yeah. It's willread.org. So it's willread.org. And you can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Literacy Coalition. And we got some great things happening. You know, really spreading the word about all of our programs, you know, through our social media platforms. So we're excited that people, you know, are interested in learning about us, but also I'm on LinkedIn, and if people are interested in finding me on LinkedIn and you want to talk about leadership and you want to talk about experiences, I'm always open to that. I love talking about leadership and how people can do a better job of being better leaders.
That's awesome. And I want to give a shout out because I'm on your website right now and I'm looking at a section that has your list out various supporters. And I see a familiar name. One of my good friends and our corporate attorney is Rad Wood. And I see his name listed there on the website. So I want to give a shout out to Rad. That's awesome.
Yeah, wonderful. yeah, thank you so much. And again, I just want people to know that, you know, yeah, I got the makeup on, I got the earrings on, everything looks great. It's been a journey to be where I am today. And there's so many people who helped me along the way, who've mentored me. I wouldn't have the CEO position if, again, I'm giving a shout out to Angela Lamont from the Kindness Campaign, because she gave me a shot at my dream to become an executive director. And then she, you know, because of that, that led to this position as CEO for this position. And so, it takes a village for
absolutely.
Sure.
Absolutely. I'm glad you mentioned that. That is really awesome. I would be remiss if we didn't give Andrew a shout out, because that's how we met, which is just so wonderful and beautiful to bring that up and come full circle here. Well, Janet, thank you again for being on this episode. Again, for those tuning in, this was a Charity Charge episode with Janet Torres, who is the CEO of Literacy Coalition of Central Texas. And you can find more information, get involved, support their work at willread.org. www.thebusinessmindset.org. Excellent. Thank you, everyone. To next time. Thanks for tuning in.
Thank you, everybody. It was awesome.